"To that stool there," she commanded at once. "At a squat with your knees wide apart and your hands behind your neck. Now!" And she drove me at once to obey as I hopped up on the stool and, with a great but quick effort, managed to secure my balance. It was that same miserable squatting position in which my stable boy lord had punished me. And all the court could now see my genitals displayed, if they hadn't seen them before. "Turn around slowly," she commanded, in order to show me to all eyes, "so the lords and ladies can see the little pet that performs for them tonight." And again she gave me numerous, exquisite cracks of the paddle. There was a sprinkling of applause from the little crowd and the sounds of wine being poured, and no sooner had I executed a complete turn, the slapping of her paddle ringing in my ears. Then she ordered me to make a quick turn around the little stage on all fours with my chin and chest on the ground, as I had done for her earlier. It was here I had to remind myself of my intentions. I rushed fast to obey, arching my back, my knees apart, yet moving swiftly as the heels of her boots clicked beside me and my buttocks were writhing under her blows. I did not try to hold their muscles still, but let them tense, let my hips even rise and fall as they were inclined to do, shrinking from the blows, yet receiving them. And as I moved along the white marble floor, the room a blur of faces over me, I felt this is my natural state. This is what I am. There is nothing before me or after me. I could hear the responses of the court. They laughed at this miserable position. And there was a growing excitement to their talk. The little performance had them much engaged, jaded as they were. I was being admired for my abandon. I groaned with each crack of the paddle without even thinking to stop it. I let the groans come freely and arched my back to even greater degree. And when the task was complete and I was again driven into the center of the circle, I heard applause around me. My cruel trainer didn't pause. She commanded me at once to hop upon another stool, and from that stool to one that was even higher. I squatted on each in turn. And when her spanks caught me, my hips moved forward with them without restraint, and my moans, my natural moans, were surprisingly loud to me. "Yes, my princess," I said after each command, and my voice sounded tremulous to me, though deep and full of suffering. "Yes, my princess," I said again as she ordered me finally to stand before her. Legs wide apart, and slowly squat until I had achieved the height of which she approved. Then I must jump through the first hoop, hands behind my neck, and somehow manage to squat again for her. "Yes, my princess," I said, and obeyed at once, and then through another hoop and another with the same compliance. I was agile and without the slightest shame, though my penis and balls moved ungracefully with my exertions. Her blows grew harder, less regular. My moans were very loud and sudden and provoked much laughter. And when she commanded me now to jump up and grab the bar of the trapeze in both hands, I felt the tears come purely from my stress and exhaustion. I hung from the trapeze as she paddled me, driving me back and forth, and then commanded me to twist and catch the chains above with my feet. This was quite impossible, and as I struggled to obey, the hall echoed with laughter. Felix stepped forward and at once lifted my ankles until I was swinging as she had wished, and I had to bear her spanks in this position. And as soon as she tired of this, I was ordered to drop to the ground, at which point she came forward with a long, thin leather strap, and buckling the end of it around my penis, she now pulled me, on my knees, towards her. I had never been so led or pulled before, by the very root of my cock, and my tears flowed copiously. My whole body was hot and trembling, and my hips were being tugged ahead of me so that no thought of grace could possibly exist, even had I the presence of mind for it. She pulled me to the queen's feet, and then, turning, pulled me along, running on her clicking heels so that I struggled and groaned and cried behind my closed lips to keep up with her. I was wretched. The circle seemed endless. The strap around my penis constricted it, and my buttocks were so painfully tender now that they ached even when she was not striking them. But we'd soon completed the circle. I knew she had exhausted her inventiveness. She had relied upon my disobedience and reluctance. And, encountering none, her show lacked any real feature save my complete obedience. But she had now a subtle test for me which I was unprepared. She ordered me to stand up, spread my legs, and then place my hands flat on the floor before her. I did so, my buttocks facing the Queen and the Grand Duke, a position which, again, even in the midst of this, reminded me of my nakedness. She put aside her paddle and picked her favorite toy then, the leather strap, and gave my legs a heavy strapping on both thighs and calves, letting the leather curl about me, and ordered me to move forward a few inches so that I might place my chin upon a high stool there. My hands must go behind my back, my back must be arched. I did as I was told, and stood spread-legged, bent at the waist, my face tipped up for all to see my miserable expression. As you can imagine, my buttocks hung free in the air, and she commenced to shower them with compliments. Very pretty hips, Prince Alexei, very pretty buttocks, tough and round and muscular. And very pretty indeed when you squirm to escape my strap and my paddle. She illustrated all this, as I did with her strap, and I was crying softly now between my moans. It was then she gave a command which surprised me. But the court wants to see you display your buttocks. They want to see you move them, she said. Not merely to escape the punishment you so richly deserve and richly need, but to see some real show of humility. I didn't know what she meant. She spanked me hard as if I meant to be stubborn, while I answered through my tears, "Yes, my princess." "But you do not obey," she cried out. She had commenced what she really wanted. And as soon as she said this, I began to sob in spite of myself. What could I say to her? "I want to see your buttocks move, prince," she said. "I want to see them dance while your feet remain still." I heard the queen laugh. And suddenly, overcome with shame and fear, I knew the seemingly small thing she wanted of me was too much for me. I moved my hips. I moved them from side to side as she spanked me, and my chest shook with another sob that I could scarce keep quiet. "No, prince, nothing so simple as that. A real dance for the court," she said. "Your reddened and punished buttocks must do something besides sleep under my blows." And she placed her hands on my hips then, and slowly moved them not only from side to side, but down and around and up, so that I had to bend my knees. She rotated them. It seems a small thing as I say it, but to me it was unspeakably shameful to have to swing my hips and rotate them, to put all my strength and spirit into this seemingly vulgar display of my buttocks. And yet she meant for me to do this. She had commanded it, and I could do nothing but obey, and my tears flowed, and my sobs caught in my throat as I rotated my buttocks as she commanded. "Bend your knees deeper, I want to see a dance," she said with a loud wallop of her strap. "Bend your knees and move those hips more to the side, more to the left." Her voice rose angrily. "You resist me, Prince Alexei, you don't amuse," she said, and rained her smacking wallops on me as I strove to obey. "Move," she cried out. She was triumphing. All my composure was truly lost. She knew it. "So you dare reserve yourself in the presence of the queen and her court," she scolded me. And then, with both her hands, she pulled my hips this way and that, making a greater rotation. I could endure it no longer. There was but one way to best her, And that was to twist in this shameful position more wildly even than she guided me. And shaking, with choked sobs, I obeyed her. There was immediate applause as I did this dance. My buttocks twisted from side to side and up and down, my knees bending deeply, my back arched, my chin resting painfully on the stool so all could see the tears coursing down my face and my obvious destruction of spirit. Yes, princess, I struggled to articulate in my supplicating voice, and I obeyed with all my strength, putting on such a good performance that the applause continued. "That's good, Prince Alexei, very good," she said. "Spread your legs wider apart, wider, and move your hips even more." I obeyed at once. I was now snapping my hips, and I was overcome with the greatest shame I had known since I had been captured and brought to the castle. Not even the first stripping by the soldiers in the field, not even being thrown over the captain's saddle, nor the raping in the kitchen compared to the degradation I knew now because I performed all this gracelessly and obsequiously. Finally, she was finished with my little display. The lords and the ladies were talking among themselves, commenting, talking of all manner of things as they always do at such things. But the murmur was full of a certain restlessness, which meant that their passions were aroused. And I did not have to look up to see they were all looking at the central circle, no matter how they might have feigned boredom. Princess Lynette now ordered me to turn slowly, keeping my chin in the center of the stool, but moving my legs in a circle, all the while swinging my buttocks so that all the court might see this display of obedience equally. My own sobs were deafening to me. I struggled to obey without losing my balance. If I flagged in the slightest with the broad rotation of my buttocks, the princess had an opportunity again to upbraid me. Finally, she raised her voice and announced to the court that we had here an obedient prince capable of even more imaginative amusements in the future. The queen clapped her hands. The assembly could now rise and disperse, but they did so very slowly, and Princess Lynette, to continue the performance for the very last onlookers, quickly ordered me to grasp the trapeze over my head, and as she spanked me relentlessly, I was ordered to lift my chin and to march in place on my toes for her. Pain shot through my calves and thighs, but the worst, as always, was the burning and swelling of my buttocks. Yet I marched with my chin up as the hall emptied. The queen had gone first. Finally, all the lords and ladies were gone. Princess Lynette gave over her paddle and her strap to Lord Gregory. I stood, holding the trapeze, my chest heaving, my limbs tingling. I had the pleasure of seeing Princess Lynette stripped of her boots and her collar by a page who threw her over his shoulder, and then she was carried out. But I couldn't see her face and did not know what she was feeling. Her buttocks were up in the air over the page's shoulder. Her pubic lips were long and thin and her pubic hair reddish. I was alone, damp all over with sweat and exhausted. Lord Gregory was standing there, and he came and lifted my chin and said, "You are unconquerable, aren't you?" I was astonished. "Miserable, proud, rebellious Prince Alexei," he said furiously. I tried to show my consternation. "Tell me how I've displeased," I begged, having heard Prince Gerald say that enough in the Queen's chamber. "You know how to take pleasure in all of it. There is nothing that is too ungraceful for you, too undignified, too difficult. You play with all of us," he said. Again, I was astonished. "Well, you will measure my cock for me now," he said, and ordered the last page to leave us. I still held the trapeze as commanded. The room was dark save for the luminous night sky through the windows. I heard him opening his clothes. I felt the nudge of his penis. And then he thrust it into my buttocks. "Damnable little prince," he said as he drove into me. When it was finished, Felix slung me over his shoulder as unceremoniously as the other page had carried Princess Lynette. My cock swelled against him, but I tried to control it. When he set me down in the queen's chamber, she sat at her dresser filing her nails. "I've missed you," she said. I hurried to her on my hands and knees and kissed her slippers. She took a white silk handkerchief and wiped my face. "You please me very well," she said. I was puzzled. What did Lord Gregory see in me that she did not see? But I was too relieved to ponder this. Had she greeted me with anger, ordered more punishments and amusements, I would have wept with despair. As it was, she was all beauty and softness. She ordered me to undress her and to turn down her bed. I obeyed as well as I could, but she refused the silk dressing gown. And for the first time, she stood before me, naked. I had not been told I could look up. I was crouched at her feet. Then she said that I might look. As you can imagine, she was unspeakably lovely. She had a firm body, powerful somewhat, with shoulders just a little too strong for a woman, and long legs. But her breasts were magnificent, and her sex was a gleaming nest of black hair. I found myself breathless. "My queen," I whispered, and after I kissed her feet, I kissed her ankles. She did not protest. I kissed her knees. She did not protest. I kissed her thighs. And then, impulsively, I buried my face in that nest of perfumed hair, finding it hot, so hot, and she lifted me up until I was standing. She lifted my arms, and I embraced her and felt, for the first time, her full, womanly form, and also that no matter how strong and powerful she appeared, she was small next to me and yielding. I moved to kiss her breasts, and she bid me silently do it, and I suckled them until she was sighing. They tasted so sweet, and they were so soft, yet plump at the same time and resistant to my respectful fingers. She sank down on the bed, and I, on my knees, buried my face between her legs again. But she said she wanted my cock now and that I must not come until she allowed it. I moaned to show how difficult this would be out of love for her. But she lay back on her pillows, opening her legs, and I saw for the first time the pink lips there. She pulled me down. I could not quite believe it when I felt the sheath of her hot vagina. It had been so long since I felt such satisfaction with a woman. Not since I had been taken prisoner by her soldiers had I felt it. I struggled not to consummate my passion at once, and when she commenced to move her hips, I thought surely I would lose the struggle. She was so wet and hot and tight, and my penis ached from punishment. All my body ached, and the aching was delicious to me. Her hands caressed my buttocks. She pinched the welts. She spread my buttocks apart, and as this hot sheathing tightened on my penis, as the roughness of her pubic hair stroked me and tantalized me, she put her fingers into my anus. My prince, you pass all tests for me," she whispered. Her movements grew swifter, wilder. I saw her face and breasts suffused with scarlet. "Now," she commanded, and I pumped my passion into her. I rocked with the pumping of it, my hips snapping as wildly as they had in the little circus performance. And when I was emptied and quiet, I lay covering her face and her breasts with languid and sleepy kisses. She sat up in bed and ran her hands all over me. She told me I was her loveliest possession. But there are many cruelties in store for you, she said. I felt myself grow hard again. She said I should be subjected to a daily discipline far worse than any she had before invented. I love you, my queen, I whispered, and had no thought other than serving her. Yet, of course, I was afraid, though I felt powerful in all I had endured and accomplished. Tomorrow, she said, I go to review my armies. I must ride before them in an open coach, as much so they can see their queen as I can see them. And after that, I must proceed through the villages nearest the castle. All the court rides with me according to rank, and all the slaves, naked and collared in leather, march on foot with us. You shall march at the side of my carriage for all eyes to see. I shall have the finest collar for you, and your anus shall be opened with a leather phallus. You shall wear a bit in your mouth, and I shall hold the bridle. You will hold your head high before soldiers, officers, the common people. And, for the pleasure of the people, I shall have you displayed in the villages in the main square long enough for all to admire before we continue the procession. Yes, my queen, I answered silently. I knew it would be a terrible ordeal, and yet I was thinking of it with curiosity, and wondering when and how my feeling of helplessness and yielding would visit me. Would it come before the villagers, or the soldiers, or when I trotted along with my head held high, my anus tortured by this phallus? Each detail she had described excited me. I slept deeply and well. When Leon awakened me, he groomed me as carefully as he had for the little circus. There was a huge commotion outside the castle. It was the first time I had seen the front gates of the courtyard, the drawbridge and moat, and all the soldiers assembled. The queen's open coach stood in the courtyard, and she was already seated, surrounded by her footmen and her pages who rode on the sides. And her coachmen with their fine caps, their plumes, and their gleaming spurs. A great mounted force of soldiers was ready. Before being led out, I was fitted with the bit by Leon, who gave my hair a last thorough combing. He wedged the leather bit well back into my mouth, wiped my lips, and then told me the hardest thing would be to keep my chin raised. I must never let it drop to a normal position. The bridle, which the queen would hold idly in her lap, could, of course, keep my head raised, but I must never lower my head. She would feel it if I did and be in a fury. Then he showed me the leather phallus. It had no straps, no belts attached to it. It was as big as a man's erect cock, and I was afraid. How should I ever keep it in? From it hung a horse's tail of thin black leather thongs for a mere decoration. He told me to spread my legs. He forced it up into my anus and told me I must keep it in place, as the queen would suffer me to be covered with nothing. The thin leather thongs hung down and stroked my thighs. They would swing like a horse's tail when I trotted along, but they were short. They would conceal nothing. Then he oiled my pubic hair again, my cock and my balls. He rubbed some oil into my belly. I had my hands clasped behind my back, and he gave me a small, leather-covered bone to hold with them, saying it would make it easier to keep them clasped. But my tasks were these: to keep my chin raised, to keep the phallus in place, and to keep my own penis hard and presentable to the queen. Then I was led out by the little bridle into the courtyard. The bright noonday sun flashed on the spears of the knights and the soldiers. The horses' hooves made a loud clatter on the stones. The queen, who was in fast conversation with the Grand Duke at her side, scarcely noticed me. She threw me one quick smile. The bridle was given her. It went up over the door of the coach and kept my head quite turned up. "Keep your eyes down at all times, respectfully," Leon said. and soon the carriage moved out of the gates and over the drawbridge. Well, you can imagine what that day was like. You were brought naked through the villages of your own kingdom. You know what it is like to be gazed at by all, soldiers, knights, commoners. It was a small consolation to me that other naked slaves would follow. I was alone by the queen's coach, and I thought only of pleasing her, and of appearing as she wanted me to appear to others. I held my head up, I contracted my buttocks to hold in the painful phallus, and soon, as we passed before hundreds upon hundreds of soldiers, I thought again, I am her servant, her slave, and this is my life. I have no other. Perhaps the most excruciating part of the day for me was the villages. You have been through the villages. I had not. The only common people I had seen were in the kitchen. But this day of military parade was also the opening of the fairs in the villages. The queen visited each of several, and after that the fair would open. There was a platform in the center of the square of each, and when the queen went inside of the house of the lord of the village to drink a cup of wine with him, I was left on display, as she had told me I would be. But I was not to stand gracefully as I might have hoped, and the villagers knew this, though I didn't. When we reached the first village, the queen went away, and as soon as my feet hit the platform, a great roar went up from the crowd, who knew they were to see something amusing. I had my head down, glad of the opportunity to move the rigid muscles of my throat and shoulders. And I was quite astonished when Felix removed the phallus from my anus. Of course, the crowd cheered at this. I was then made to kneel up, hands behind my neck, on a turntable. Felix operated it with his foot, and telling me to spread my legs wide, he turned the turntable. I was perhaps more afraid in these first few moments than ever before, but never once did the fear of rising and trying to escape come to me. I was virtually helpless. Naked, a slave of the queen, I was in the midst of hundreds of common people who would have overpowered me at once, and cheerfully for all the sport it would have given them. It was then that I realized escape was quite impossible. Any naked prince or princess fleeing the castle would have been apprehended by these villagers. They would have given no shelter. Now Felix commanded me to show to the crowd all my private parts that were in the service of the queen, and that I was her slave and her animal. I did not understand these words, which were spoken ceremoniously. So he told me politely enough that I must part the cheeks of my buttocks as I bent over and display for them my open anus. Of course, this was a symbolic gesture. It meant I was ever to be violated, and nothing more than that which could be violated. But my face aflame, my hands trembling, I obeyed. A great cheer went up from the crowd. Tears slipped down my face. With a long cane, Felix lifted my balls for them to see and pushed my penis this way and that to display its defenselessness. And all the while I had to hold my buttocks apart and display my anus. Whenever I relaxed my hands, he commanded me sharply to pull the flesh wider apart and threatened me with chastisement. That will infuriate her highness, he said, and amuse the crowd immensely. Then, to a loud, approving cry, the phallus was shoved securely back into my anus. I was made to press my lips to the wood of the turntable, and I was led back to my position beside the queen's coach, Felix pulling my bridle over his shoulder as I trotted with my head lifted behind him. By the last village, I was no more used to it than at the first. But by this time, Felix had assured the queen that I displayed all conceivable humility. My beauty was unrivaled by that of any past prince. Half the village youth of both sexes was in love with me. The queen kissed my eyelids when I received those compliments. There was a grand banquet that night at the castle. You've seen such a banquet as there was one held for you at your presentation. I had not seen it before, and I had my first experience of serving wine for the queen and for the others to whom she sent me ceremoniously as a gift now and then. When my eyes caught those of Princess Lynette, I smiled at her without thinking about it. I felt I could do anything I was commanded to do. I had no fear of anything. And so I can say by then I had yielded. But the truest indication of my yielding was that both Leon and Lord Gregory, when they had the chance, told me I was obdurate and rebellious. They said I mocked everything. I said this was not true when I had the opportunity to answer. But I seldom had such an opportunity. Many other things have happened to me since then, but the lessons learned in those early months were most important. Princess Lynette is still here, of course. You'll come to know who she is in time. And though I can bear anything from my queen, from Lord Gregory, and from Leon, I still find it difficult to bear Princess Lynette. But I should stake my life on it that no one knows this. Now, it's almost morning. I must return you to the dressing room, and also bathe you so no one knows we've been together. But I've told you my story so that you can understand what it means to yield, and that each of us must find his or her own path to acceptance. There is more, however, to my story which will only reveal itself to you in time. But let it stand by you in simple ways now. If you must bear a punishment which seems too great for you, think to yourself, "Ah, but Alexei bore this, so therefore it can be borne." Beauty did not mean to silence him, but she could not restrain her embraces. She was as hungry for him now as she had been earlier, but it was too late. And as he led her back to the dressing room, she wondered whether or not he could guess the true effect of his words upon her. Could he know that he had inflamed and fascinated her, and amplified for her an understanding of resignation and yielding which she had already felt? As he bathed her, wiping away all evidence of his love, she remained still, caught in her thoughts. What had she felt earlier this night when the queen had said that she wanted to send her home on account of the crown prince's excessive devotion? Had she wanted to leave? A horrid thought obsessed her. She saw herself asleep in that dusty chamber that had been her prison for 100 years. She heard whispers all about her. The old witch with the spindle that had pricked Beauty's finger was laughing through her toothless gums and lifting her hand to Beauty's breasts. She exuded some lewd sensuality. Beauty shuddered. She winced and struggled as Alexei tightened the shackles. "Don't be afraid. We've had the night together undiscovered," he assured her. She stared at him as if she did not know him, because she was not afraid of anyone in the castle. Not of him, the prince, the queen. It was her mind that frightened her. The sky was paling. Alexei embraced her. She was now bound to the wall, her long hair pressed between her back and the stones behind her. And she could not get out of that dusty chamber in her homeland. And it seemed to her she was traveling up through layers and layers of sleep. And this dressing room about her in this cruel country had lost its substantiality. A prince had come into her sleeping chamber. A prince had lowered his lips to her. But it was only Alexei kissing her, wasn't it? Alexei kissing her here? But when she opened her eyes on that ancient bed and looked at the one who now broke her spell, she saw some bland and innocent countenance. It was not her crown prince. It was not Alexei. It was some pristine soul likened to her own who now stood back from her in astonishment. Brave he was. Yes, brave and without complexity. She cried out, "No!" But Alexei's hand was over her mouth. "Beauty, what is it?" "Don't kiss me," she whispered. But when she saw the pain in his face, she opened her mouth and felt his lips sealed over it. His tongue filled her. She pressed her lips against him. Ah, it is you. Only you, she whispered.
And what did you think it was? Were you dreaming?
It seemed for a moment all this was a dream, she confessed.
But the stone was too real.
His touch, too real.
And why shouldn't it be a dream? Is it such a nightmare?
She shook her head. You love it. All of it. You love it, she whispered in his ear. She saw his eyes linger languidly on her and then drift away. And it seemed a dream because all the past, the real past, has lost its luster. But what was she saying? That in these few days she had not once longed for her homeland? She had not once longed for what her youth had been? And the sleep of 100 years had given her no wisdom?
I love it. I loathe it, Alexei said. I am humiliated by it and recreated by it. And yielding means to feel all those things at once, and yet to be of one mind and one spirit.
Yes, she sighed, as though she had falsely accused him. Wicked pain, wicked pleasure.
And he gave her his smile of approbation. We'll be together soon again.
Yes.
Be sure of it. And until then, my darling, my love, belong to everyone.
The village.
The next few days passed as quickly for Beauty as those before them. No one discovered that she and Alexei had been together. The following night, the prince told her she had gained his mother's approval. She would now be trained by him as his little maid, to sweep his quarters, to keep his wine cup always filled, and to perform all those duties that Alexei performed for her highness. And from then on, Beauty would sleep in the prince's quarters. She found herself envied by everyone, and it was the prince and the prince alone who prescribed her daily punishments. Each morning she was given to Lady Juliana for the bridal path. Then Beauty would serve the wine at the noon meal, and woe to her if she spilt a drop of it. Then she would sleep in the afternoons so she might be fresh to attend the prince in the evenings. And next festival night, she would be entered in a race of bridal path slaves which he expected her to win after her daily training. All this Beauty heard out with flushes and tears, again and again stooping to kiss the prince's boots as he gave his orders. He seemed still troubled in his love, and while the castle slept, he frequently awakened her with rough embraces. She could scarcely think of Alexei at these times, the prince so frightened her and scrutinized her. And when each day dawned, she was brought out in her leather horseshoe boots for Lady Juliana. Beauty was frightened, but she was ready. Lady Juliana was a vision of loveliness in her crimson riding dress, and Beauty ran fast on the soft gravel path, the sun often causing her to squint as it flashed in the overhanging trees. And she was weeping when it was finished. Then she and Lady Juliana would be alone together in the garden. Lady Juliana carried a leather strap, but seldom did she use it. And the garden was soothing to Beauty. They would sit down on the grass, Lady Juliana's skirts a wreath of embroidered silk about her. And quite suddenly, Lady Juliana might give Beauty a deep kiss that startled Beauty and weakened her. Lady Juliana stroked Beauty all over. She lavished her with kisses and compliments, and when she did beat her with a leather strap, Beauty cried softly with deep, moaning breaths and a languid sense of abandon. Very soon she was gathering little flowers in her teeth for Lady Juliana, or with great grace kissing the hem of her skirts, or even the white hands, all of these gestures delighting her mistress. "Ah, I am becoming what Alexei wanted me to become," Beauty thought. But most of the time she did not think at all. At meals she took great care to serve the wine gracefully. Yet there came that moment when she spilt the wine and must take her punishment dangling from the page's strong grip, scampering afterwards to the prince's boots to beg silently for forgiveness. The prince was furious with her, and when he ordered her spanked again, she was scalded with humiliation. That night he whipped her mercilessly with his belt before taking her. He told her he loathed the slightest imperfection in her, and she was chained to the wall to spend the night in weeping and misery. She dreaded new and frightening punishments. Lady Juliana hinted that Beauty was but a virgin in some respects, that she was being tried very slowly. And Beauty feared Lord Gregory, too, who was always watching her. One morning when she stumbled on the bridle path, Lady Juliana threatened her with the hall of punishments. Beauty fell to her hands and knees at once, kissing Lady Juliana's slippers. And though Lady Juliana relented at once with a smile and a toss of her pretty braids, Lord Gregory, nearby, showed his disapproval. Beauty's heart was a throbbing pain in her chest as she was led away for grooming. If only she could see Alexei, she mused. And yet he had lost some of his charm for her. And why, she was not certain. Even as she lay on her bed that afternoon, she thought of the prince and Lady Juliana. "My lords and masters," she whispered to herself, and wondered why Leon had given her nothing to make her sleep when she was not tired at all and tortured by the little throb of passion between her legs as always. But she had been resting only an hour when Lady Juliana came for her. "I don't much approve of it myself," Lady Juliana said, as she forced Beauty out into the garden. "But His Highness must let you see those poor slaves being packed off to the village." Again, the village. Beauty tried to conceal her curiosity. Lady Juliana thrashed her idly with the leather belt, light but stinging blows, as they moved down the path together. Finally, they reached an enclosed garden full of low-limbed flowering trees, and on a stone bench, Beauty saw the prince and a handsome young lord at his side who was talking to the prince earnestly. "That is Lord Stefan," Lady Juliana confided in a hushed voice, "and you must show him the utmost respect. He is the prince's favorite cousin. Besides, he is quite miserable today. It is his precious and disobedient Prince Tristan who is the cause of it." "Ah, and if I could only see Prince Tristan," Beauty thought. She had not forgotten Alexei's mention of him. An incomparable slave who knew the meaning of yielding. So he had caused trouble, had he? She could not help but observe that Lord Stefan was very handsome. Golden-haired and gray-eyed, his youthful face was heavy with brooding and unhappiness. His eyes rested on Beauty only for a second as she drew near, and though he seemed to acknowledge her charms, he lapsed again into listening to the prince, who lectured him sternly. "You bear him too much love. It's the same with me and this princess you see before you. You must curb your love as I must curb mine. Believe me, I understand even as I condemn you."
"Oh, but the village?" murmured the young lord.
"He must go, and he will be the better for it."
"Oh, heartless prince," whispered Lady Juliana.
She urged Beauty forward to kiss Lord Stefan's boots as she took her side beside both of them. Poor Prince Tristan will be in the village the whole summer. The prince lifted Beauty's chin and bent to take a kiss from her lips, which filled Beauty with a softening torment. But she was too curious about all that was being said, and dared not make the slightest movement to attract him.
"I must ask you," Lord Stefan began. "Would you send Princess Beauty to the village if you felt she deserved it?"
"Of course I would," said the prince. But he did not sound convincing. "I would do it in an instant."
"Oh, but you couldn't," Lady Juliana protested.
"She doesn't deserve it, so it does not matter," the prince insisted. "But we are talking about Prince Tristan. And Prince Tristan, for all the abuse and punishments he has endured, remains a mystery to everyone. He needs the rigors of the village, just as Prince Alexei once needed the kitchen to teach him humility." Lord Stefan was deeply troubled, and the words rigor and humility seemed to pierce him. He rose and begged the prince to come with him and make a better judgment of it.
"They go tomorrow. The weather is already very warm, and the villagers are already preparing for the auction. I've sent him to the prisoner's yard to wait there."
"Come, Beauty," the prince said, rising. "It will be good for you to see this and come to understand it."
Beauty was intrigued and followed eagerly, but the prince's coldness and sternness made her uneasy. She tried to remain close to Lady Juliana as they proceeded along the pathway, out of the gardens, past the kitchen and stables, to a plain, dirty yard in which she saw a great cart, without its horse, standing on four wheels against the walls that surrounded the castle. There were common soldiers here, menials. She felt her nakedness as she was made to follow the brightly dressed trio. Her welts and cuts smarted anew, and fearfully she looked up to see a small pen, fenced in crude sticks in which a gaggle of naked princes and princesses stood with their hands bound to the backs of their necks, milling as if it were less exhausting to walk than to stand by the hour. A common soldier dealt a blow now through the fence with a heavy leather belt that sent a squealing princess toward the middle of the group for cover. And, catching other naked buttocks, he walloped them as well, producing a groan from a young prince who turned to him resentfully. It infuriated Beauty to see this lowly soldier abusing such lovely white legs and bottoms. Yet she could not keep her eyes off the slaves who backed away from the fence, only to be tormented from the other side by another idle, devilish boy who struck much harder and with much more deliberation. But now the soldiers saw the prince and bowed at once, showing him the strictest attention. And it seemed at that same moment the slaves saw the little group approaching. Moans and whimpers commenced from those who struggled in spite of their gags to make their plight known, and their muffled cries became a lamentation. They seemed as beautiful as any slave's Beauty had seen, and as they writhed now, some of them dropping on their knees before the prince, she saw here and there a lovely peach-colored sex beneath curls of pubic hair or breasts quivering with crying. The princes were, many of them, painfully erect as if they could not control it. And one of them had pressed his lips to the rough ground as the prince and Lord Stefan and Lady Juliana, with Beauty at her side, drew up to the little fence to inspect them. The prince's eyes were angry and cold, but Lord Stefan appeared shaken, and Beauty perceived that his gaze was fixed on one very dignified prince who neither wailed or bowed nor in any way begged for mercy. He was as fair as was the young lord, his eyes very blue, and though the mean little gag distorted his mouth, his face was otherwise serene as ever she had seen Prince Alexei's. He looked down humbly enough, and Beauty tried to conceal her fascination with his exquisitely sculpted limbs and his swelling organ. He seemed
in great distress, however, behind his indifferent expression. Lord Stefan suddenly turned his back as if he could not quite contain himself.
"Don't be so sentimental. He deserves his time in the village," the prince said coldly.
And with an imperious gesture, he ordered the other wailing princes and princesses to be silent. The guards watched all with folded arms, smiling at the spectacle. And Beauty dared not look at them, for fear their eyes would meet hers, giving further humiliation. But the prince ordered her to come forward and to kneel up and listen to his instruction.
"Beauty, look on these unfortunates," the prince said with obvious disapproval.
"They are going to the queen's village, which is the largest and most prosperous in the country. It houses the families of all those who serve here. The craftsmen there make our linen, our simple furniture, supply us with wine, food, milk, and butter. There is the dairy there, and the fowl are raised on the little farms, and there are all those who make up a town in any location." Beauty stared at the captive princes and princesses, who, though they could no longer beg with groans and cries, still bowed before the prince, who seemed indifferent to them.
"It is perhaps the loveliest village in the realm," the prince went on, "with a stern lord mayor and many inns and taverns that are the favorites of the soldiers. But it is allowed one special privilege that no other village enjoys. And that is to purchase, at auction, for the warm months, those princes and princesses in need of dire punishment. Anyone in the village may purchase a slave if he or she has the gold for it." It seemed at this some of the captives could not prevent themselves from imploring the prince, and with a snap of his fingers he ordered the guards to go to work with their belts and long paddles, causing an immediate uproar. The miserable, desperate slaves huddled together, turning their vulnerable breasts and organs towards their tormentors, as if at all costs they must protect their sore backsides. But the tall, yellow-haired Prince Tristan made no move to protect himself, merely allowing himself to be jostled by the others. His eyes had never left his lord, but now slowly they turned and fixed upon Beauty. Beauty's heart contracted. She felt a slight dizziness. She stared straight into those unreadable blue eyes, while at the same time she thought, "Ah, this is the village." "It is wretched service," Lady Juliana went on, obviously imploring the prince. "The auction itself takes place as soon as the slaves arrive, and you can well suppose that even the beggars and common louts about town are there to witness it. Why, the whole village declares a holiday. Each poor slave is carried off by his or her master, not only to degradation and punishment, but miserable labor. Mind you, the crude, practical people of the village do not keep even the loveliest prince or princess for mere pleasure." Beauty was remembering Alexei's description of his exposure in the villages. The high wooden platform in the marketplace, the crude crowd, and their celebration of his humiliation. She felt her sex secretly ache with desire, and yet she was horrified. "Ah, but for all its roughness and cruelty," said the prince, now glancing at the inconsolable Lord Stefan, who stood still with his back to the unfortunates. "It is a sublime punishment. Few slaves can learn from a year in the castle what they learn from the warm months in the village. And of course, they cannot be really hurt any more than slaves here. The same strict rules apply: no cutting, no burning, no real wounding. And each week, they are herded to a slave's hall for bathing and oiling. But when they return to the castle, they are more than sweet or meek. They have been reborn with incomparable strength and beauty."
"Yes, as Prince Alexei was reborn," Beauty thought, her heart pounding. She wondered if anyone could see her perplexity and excitement. She saw the distant Prince Tristan among the others, his blue eyes calmly fixed to the back of his master, Lord Stefan, Her mind was filled with lurid visions. And what was it Alexei had said? That such a punishment had been merciful, and that if she found it too difficult to learn slowly, she might make herself ripe for some heavier punishment? Lady Juliana was shaking her head and making little tisks. "But it is only spring now," she said. "Why, the poor darlings will be there forever. Ah, the heat, the flies, and the labor, you cannot imagine how they are used. And the soldiers crowding the taverns and the inns, at last able to buy for a few coins a lovely prince or princess that they should never possess in a lifetime." "You make too much of it," the prince insisted. "But would you send your own slave?" Lord Stefan appealed to him again. "I don't want him to go," he murmured. "And yet I condemned him, and before the queen." "Then you have no choice, and yes, I would send my own slave, though no slave of the queen or the crown prince has ever been so punished." The prince turned his back to the slaves almost contemptuously. But Beauty continued to look as the beautiful Prince Tristan commenced to push his way forward. He reached the fence, and though a haughty guard who was having much sport with the group flailed at him with the leather belt, he did not move, nor show the slightest discomfort. "Ah, he is appealing to you," Lady Juliana sighed, and at once Lord Stefan turned, and the two young men faced each other. Beauty watched as if in a trance, as Lord Tristan knelt now, slowly and gracefully, and kissed the ground before his master. "It's too late," said the prince, "and this little sign of affection and humility counts for nothing." Prince Tristan rose and stood with his eyes down in perfect patience, and Lord Stefan rushed forward and, reaching over the fence, embraced him immediately. He crushed Prince Tristan to his chest and kissed him all over his face and his hair. The captive prince, his hands bound to the back of his neck, quietly returned the kisses. The prince was in a rage. Lady Juliana was laughing. The prince pulled Lord Stefan away and said they must leave these miserable slaves now. Tomorrow they would be in the village. Beauty lay on her bed afterwards, unable to think of anything but the little group in the prison yard. Yet she saw, too, the narrow, crooked streets of the villages she'd passed on her journey. She remembered the inns with their painted signs over the gates, the half-timbered houses shadowing her path, and those tiny, diamond-paned windows. She would never forget the men and women in coarse breeches and white aprons, with sleeves rolled to the elbows. How they had gaped at her, enjoyed her helplessness. She could not sleep, and she was filled with a strange new terror. It was dark when the prince at last sent for her, and as soon as she reached the door of his private dining room, she saw that he was with Lord Stefan. It seemed, in that moment, her fate was decided. She smiled as she thought of all his boasting to Lord Stefan, and she wanted to enter quickly now. But Lord Gregory held her back at the threshold. Beauty let her eyes mist over. She did not see the prince in his velvet tunic emblazoned with the coat of arms. Rather, she saw those village cobblestone streets, the wives with their wicker brooms, the common lads in the tavern. But Lord Gregory was speaking to her. "Don't you think I see the change in you?" he hissed low in her ear, so that it seemed part of her imagination. Her eyebrows knit in a frown of annoyance, and then she dropped her eyes. "You're infected with the same poison as Prince Alexei. I see it working on you every day. You will soon make a mockery of everything." Her pulse quickened. Lord Stefan at the supper table looked so forlorn, and the prince was as proud as ever. "What you need is a severe lesson," Lord Gregory continued in his acid whisper.
"My lord, you can't mean the village," Beauty shuddered.
"No, I don't mean the village." He was obviously shocked. "And don't be flippant and bold with me. You know what I mean. The Hall of Punishments."
"Ah, your domain, where you are, prince,"
Beauty whispered, but he did not hear her. And the prince, with an air of indifference, had snapped his fingers for her to enter. She approached on her hands and knees, but she had come only a few paces into the room when she stopped.
"Go on," Lord Gregory hissed at her angrily.
The prince had not yet noticed. But when he turned and looked at her crossly, still, she did not move. Her head bowed, her eyes fixed on him. And when she saw the anger and outrage in his face, she turned suddenly and ran on her hands and knees past Lord Gregory and into the passage.
"Stop her! Stop her!"
the prince cried out before he could prevent himself. And when Beauty saw Lord Gregory's boots beside her, she rose to her full height and ran faster. He caught her by the hair, and she screamed as she felt herself pulled back and thrown over his shoulder. She beat on his back with her fists, kicking as he held her knees tight, and she wept hysterically. She could hear the prince's angry voice, but she could not make out the words. And when let down again at his feet, she ran again so that two pages came pounding after her. She struggled as she was gagged and bound, and she did not know where she was being taken. It was dark, and they were descending stairs, and she knew an appalling moment of regret and panic. They would hang her in the Hall of Punishments, and if she could not endure even that, how would she endure the village? But a strange calm came over her, even before her captors had reached the slaves' hall. And when she was thrust in a dark cell to lie on the cold stone floor with her bonds cutting into her flesh, she knew a quiet exhilaration. Yet she continued to weep, her sex pulsing, it seemed, with her sobs, and there was only silence around her. It was almost morning when she was roused. Lord Gregory snapped his fingers as the pages undid her fetters and lifted her to her feet on legs that were weak and unsteady. She felt the wallop of Lord Gregory's belt.
"Spoilt, disgraceful princess," he hissed between his teeth.
But she was drowsy, softened with desire and dreaming of the village. She gave a little cry as she felt his angry blows, but she realized, with wonder, that the pages were gagging her again and binding her hands to the back of her neck roughly. She was going to the village.
"Oh, Beauty, Beauty," came Lady Juliana's voice, crying beside her. "Why did you become afraid? Why did you try to run? You had been so good and strong, my darling."
"Spoilt, arrogant one."
Lord Gregory cursed her again as she was driven towards the open doorway. She could see the morning sky over the treetops.
"You did it deliberately,"
Lord Gregory whispered in her ear, as he whipped her onto the garden path.
"Well, you shall rue the day, and how bitterly you will weep, and there will be no one there to hear you."
Beauty struggled to keep from smiling. But could they have seen a smile behind the cruel leather bit in her teeth? It did not matter. She was running fast, with her knees lifted, around the side of the castle as Lord Gregory pointed the way, his blows quick and smarting, and Lady Juliana wept as she ran along too.
"Oh, Beauty, I can't bear it."
The stars were not yet faded away, yet the air was already warm and caressing. They crossed the empty prison yard, entering the courtyard between the great doors and the lowered drawbridge of the castle. And there stood the huge cart of slaves, already tethered to the heavy white mares who would pull it down to the village. For one moment, Beauty knew terror, but a delicious abandon took hold of her. The slaves wailed as they huddled together behind the low railing, and the driver had already taken his place, while the cart was surrounded by mounted soldiers.
"One more!"
Lord Gregory called to the captain of the guard. And Beauty heard the cries of the slaves grow louder. She was lifted by heavy hands, her legs dangling in the air.
"All right, little princess.
The captain laughed as he set her down in the cart, and Beauty felt its rough wood beneath her feet as she struggled to keep her balance. For one instant, she glanced back and saw the tear-stained face of Lady Juliana. Why, she is actually suffering, Beauty thought in amazement. And high above, she suddenly saw the prince and Lord Stefan in the only torch-lit window of the dark castle. It seemed the prince saw her look up. And the slaves about her, seeing the window as well, set up a chorus of vain pleading. The prince turned away miserably, just as Lord Stefan had turned his back on the captives earlier. Beauty felt the cart move. The great wheels creaked and the horse's hooves rang on the cobblestones. All about her, the frantic slaves tumbled against one another. She looked before her, and almost at once saw the calm blue eyes of Prince Tristan. He struggled towards her as she moved towards him, though around them the slaves flinched and squirmed to avoid the spirited thrashing from the guards who rode along beside them. Beauty felt the deep cut of a strap on her calf, but Prince Tristan was now pressed against her. Her breasts were sealed to his warm chest, and her cheek rested against his shoulder. His thick, rigid organ passed between her wet thighs and stroked her sex roughly. Struggling not to fall, she mounted the organ and felt it slip inside her. She thought of the village, the auction soon to begin, all the terrors that awaited her. And when she thought of her dear defeated prince and her poor, grieving Lady Juliana, she was again smiling. But Prince Tristan filled her mind as he struggled, it seemed, with his whole body to pierce her and enfold her. Even among the cries of the others, she heard his whisper behind his gag. Beauty, are you frightened? No, she shook her head. She pressed her tortured mouth to his, and as he lifted her with his thrusts, she felt his heart pounding against her. This is Samantha Prescott. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged recording of The Claiming of Sleeping Beauty by Anne Rice, writing as A.N. Roquelaure. This program was produced by Dion Audio Services. The director was Bob Dion. Executive producer, Karen Jakonski. Text copyright, A.N. Roquelaure, 1983. Production copyright, 2012 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.